Every member of this committee veto this photo ID bill. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Ilo Madden, M-A-D-D-E-N.
Ilo Madden. Thank you very much, Ms. Madden.
You're welcome. How do you put this back together?
Carolyn Jackson. I've been informed we're going to continue taking testimony in this location. We'll just keep going. We won't break for anything else. The other committee has been moved to 123.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my colleague Jana is going to give the testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Jana Curran. I am the public education coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota is funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend the constitutional rights under the United States and Minnesota Constitution. The United States Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law in a decision known as Crawford. The Crawford decision held that on its face, a photo identification requirement for voting did not violate the right to vote. The court established a balancing test where the court must balance a state's interest in the voting rule against the burden imposed by the rule. Because the case was not based on individuals who were actually impacted, but only on the theory that this would disenfranchise voters, the court held that the burden did not outweigh the compelling interest in election integrity. If you apply this balancing test to Senate File 1577, you have to look at what is the state's compelling interest and what is the burden imposed. There is zero evidence of voter impersonation fraud in Minnesota, despite massive efforts both in statewide election recounts and by advocacy groups to find such evidence. The only voter fraud found was people with felony sentences who were on parole or probation, who registered to vote or voted despite the fact that their voting rights were not yet restored. The simple and nearly cost-free answer to that problem is to allow persons who are not currently incarcerated to vote, not to have a constitutional amendment on voter ID. The much bigger problem is the fact that over 47% of eligible voters did not actually cast a ballot in 2010. Therefore, while the state has a compelling interest in election integrity, there is no credible evidence of an existing problem. So if you look at what is the burden, if you look at the raw numbers, as was stated earlier today, approximately 215,000 registered voters lack a state-issued photo ID card which would enable them to vote. That is about 5.4% of the population. At the least, you would look at 5.4% of the 4 million voters in Minnesota lack the requisite ID card. We can't discount the votes of these individuals just because they are in the minority. Their votes shouldn't count for less. So now we'll look at what is the burden of obtaining an ID on an individual. This picture I have up here is of my grandmother, Ramona Curran. She's a 78-year-old woman who lives in Hawley, Minnesota. She recently downsized from a 3-bedroom to a 1-bedroom apartment to cut back on expenses because she lives on a fixed income. At the same time she moved, she was denied a renewal for her driver's license because she could not pass the test. So she did not get a new ID card with her current address. She has no family who lives in town and no mode of transportation. She always votes, and if the elections were held today, she would not be able to vote. In order to get her supposedly free ID, she would have to find someone to drive her to the nearest DVS that issues state ID cards, which is 25 miles away, and ensure she had all the proper documentation to get that ID card. When I told her about this impending law, she said she had no idea they were even debating it, and she didn't understand why, after voting consistently for her whole life, she would have to change how she voted. She's able to cash checks and do all her normal tasks without a current ID and didn't know she would need one since she no longer drives. While she remains very, active in general, my grandmother grew anxious at the thought of not being able to vote and having to find her birth certificate and marriage license and checking to see if there are even the registered copies. Now, could my grandma eventually get an ID? Well, probably, because she has family members like myself who know what is going on, will take the requisite days off of work that she would need to help get her ID, but not everyone has that luxury. This is the burden we will be putting on the elderly. This burden will be put on others of limited means and mobility. This is the burden will be put on highly mobile people who move frequently, either because they are young and not yet established or because they are poor and their lack of means makes them have to move a lot. If Senate File 1577 were just a bill for a new law, I would tell the legislative decision makers points of law and fact, sit for questions, and listen to the deliberations. The Minnesota Constitution would still protect the people whose voting rights were affected, and they could sue under the Constitution and tell a judge their story. But by making it a constitutional amendment, this puts my grandmother's ability to vote up to a vote of strangers. Her rights and the rights of thousands of others just like her would be left to the kindness of strangers, with no affordable way of telling their story. Therefore, I urge you to vote no on Senate File 1577. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Curran, is Curran, correct?
Yes, correct.
Thank you. Were there any quick questions for Ms. Curran? Otherwise, we'll continue with the testimony. Ms. Jackson, did you have anything you want to say? Or okay, thank you very much. In the interest of time, Marie, is it Regstad? Marie Regstad?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Marie Rigstead. I'm the Public Policy Manager for Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And thank
Excuse
you for letting me
go Rigstead, next. Excuse me, Ms. Rigstead, could you pull that? That one's a little,
Yes.
There you go. Thank you.
I want to make sure you can all hear me. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Like I said, I'm the Public Policy Manager for Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, and we do strongly oppose this bill. I'd just like to mention, during the conversation earlier, I believe in a response to Senator McGuire, Senator Newman mentioned that people have the ability to prove who they are and where they live, and that's just simply not true for many of our clients. I know a lot of you are familiar with our Dorothy Day Center, just a few miles down the road on West 7th, and most of the folks there, well, first of all, they don't have a current address. They're staying in a homeless shelter. So if a current address is required on their photo ID, that's simply not an option because they don't have one. But if a current address is not required, they still don't have the ability to get the ID that they need. These folks, hardly any of them have a birth certificate. I would posit to say none of them have a birth certificate. Folks who have been living on the street wonder where they're going to live, where they're going to sleep that night, what they're going to eat. They usually have one bag with all of their worldly belongings in it, and a birth certificate is not one of them. If it was, it probably would have gotten wet or lost or stolen at some point anyway. To get a birth certificate, as a few people have mentioned, is not necessarily easy. It often requires a photo ID. In Minnesota, it costs $16 to get a copy of a birth certificate. That needs to be requested either online, and most of our clients don't have access to computers or internet, or in person, and the county auditor's office can be quite a distance for somebody without a car. If somebody's born outside of Minnesota, it can be even more difficult. Birth certificates range about $10 to $25, but I looked yesterday, and in Maine it's $60, 6-0, for somebody who might be living with their sole income of general assistance and $203 a month. $60 is a really significant cost to pay simply to get an ID to be able to vote. I also noticed Senator Newman mentioned a woman, I believe, from the South who would be benefited by this bill by getting to have a free ID. But he also mentioned that she'd never had a birth certificate, and so I'm not sure how she would get such an ID if she didn't have a birth certificate. Just to note, too, in California, it takes, what, 18 weeks to get a birth certificate. In Connecticut, it's 3 months. And in Georgia, you have to print out a form online, so you have to have access to a computer in order to do that. So to get to be able to vote, a lot of our clients then would need to get their birth certificate, which means paying for it, probably paying for a notary in most states, a marriage certificate if they've changed their name. They'd have to do that months ahead of time, get any other supporting documents they need, and then could get somewhere to the auditor's office or a driver's license office to finally ask for their free identification, which at that point would not be free. So just to be clear, a person who doesn't have a permanent place to sleep at night, I think we all know, has the exact same right to vote as anyone who rents or owns a home. That should not be a question. Another group that I just want to point on, because I know a lot of other folks have, is a lot of our elderly clients. And those folks are, you know, like Senator Harrington said, our parents and our grandparents, and they have a hard time getting around. They don't need an ID for anything except voting. And so to get an ID simply to vote would be really difficult, especially if vouching is no longer allowed under the law. Just to sum up, passage of this constitutional amendment will undoubtedly have the effect of barring many people from voting. The Constitution does state that senators and representatives will be chosen by the people. It does not say the people who can afford a copy of their birth certificate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Riegstad. Any questions for Ms. Riegstad? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Amanda Bardoner.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Yep, for the record, my name is Amanda Bardoner. I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. We represent the over 75,000 students that attend the seven Minsky universities at Winona, Mankato, Southwest, Moorhead, St. Cloud, Bemidji, and Metropolitan State. Our students have very real concerns about the proposal before you today. Our organization has done a great deal of nonpartisan work on all seven of our campuses, registering voters and promoting the importance of voting for students. As an association, we spend time and resources on voter registration and encouraging students to vote because we believe it is essential for the students who are going to be our future citizens and workers of our state to participate in the political process. MSUSA devotes a lot of energy to carefully explaining our voter registration requirements. Becoming a voter can be a daunting and unfamiliar process. We have found that educating students about the process reduces the confusion and drastically increases voter registration. If we add a whole new layer of rules, regulations, and processes with the constitutional amendment, it will lead to countless young citizens not exercising their legal right to vote. Put simply, this proposed constitutional amendment will reduce the number of students who vote. I respectfully ask the committee to bear in mind these consequences and weigh the heavy burden this legislation imposes against the actual risk of the fraudulent votes being cast. I would urge the legislature to reconsider the major election reform and continue discussions with the governor and concerned stakeholders. If this were to pass in November, it would fast-track this, the statutory process. And this is a critical issue that deserves more vetting through the legislative process with all of the concerned citizens here before you today. Thank you. I'll stand if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Bardoner.
Thank you.
Sydney Jordan. Sydney Jordan still here? Okay. Welcome.
Hello, committee. My name is Sydney Jordan. I work with the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, and I am a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I, along with thousands of my fellow students across the strait, are extremely concerned about the possibility of a constitutional amendment mandating a photo ID with a current address to vote. If passed, such an amendment would deter many students, including myself, from voting, as many of us do not possess IDs with our current address on them. My ID lists my parents' address in Illinois. I haven't bothered to change it since I have moved once a year since enrolling at the U. I don't want to vote in Illinois because, quite frankly, I don't live there. I spent all but 3 weeks of 2011 in Minnesota, and I hope to continue living here after graduation. In 2010, I even filled out my census here in Minnesota. Our state's inclusive voting laws have enabled countless students to become further integrated into this state as we exercise our civic duty to vote. The college years are when students form the habits that last for the rest of our lives. When our first voting experiences are positive ones, it reinforces the necessity to make voting painless and possible for every single person. Although issues of voter fraud have been brought up, the reality of this is that almost all students vote responsibly and passionately. We should not live in a state where it is easier for a young adult to purchase cigarettes and alcohol than it is for them to vote. Minnesota has the highest voter turnout in the country. This is something that we should celebrate, not punish, which is exactly what a constitutional amendment of this nature would do.
Any questions for Ms. Jordan? Thank you, Ms. Jordan.
Thank you.
Next up is going to be Kathy Bonifield and Senator Newman. Senator Newman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Are you doing okay? Do you need to step away for a minute?
Let's keep going for a little while yet.
Well, we'll keep going, but you can, take a break if you'd like.
I may take a run here.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mrs. Bonifield, please state your name for the record. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Kathy Bonifield, and I'm the Executive Director for Citizens for Election Integrity Minnesota. I'm here today to speak against a voter photo ID requirement. The only type of fraud a voter photo ID can prevent is voter impersonation. And we have no problem or no evidence of that problem occurring here in Minnesota. I'm not saying we do not have a problem. The problem that we have is felons who have voted or have registered to vote. And as you know, not one single government-issued ID has someone's criminal status on it. I'm very pleased with the recommendations found in the interim report of the Task Force on Election Integrity. I'm also pleased that they will continue to study the attributes and dynamics of the North Dakota model, which allows non-incarcerated felons the right to vote. I believe that is the solution to the felon voting problem. Furthermore, studies show that probationers and parolees who exercise their right to vote have significantly lower recidivism rates than those who did not vote. Currently, 1 out of 10 African-American Minnesotans who are of voting age cannot vote. If this was shifted to disenfranchising only those who are incarcerated, the number would shift to 3 or 4 out of 100. It's important to know that. Some say that a voter photo ID is a solution in search of a problem. It isn't. It is not a solution. It is a problem. And it may have many unintended consequences. For example, in the NAACP of Milwaukee's filing, 3 individuals reported when they went to the DMVs, the computers malfunctioned. Thus, if they had appropriate documentation, they couldn't get an ID. The problem DMVs were in Hudson and Milwaukee, so the problem was not localized. I'm not saying that the malfunctioning computers were intentional, but rather I'm expressing my concern a requirement to vote can be controlled by those who provide access to the voter photo ID. This differs from other requirements. After a citizen turns 18, the state can't make them 17. And while the state can determine the definition of a felony, a citizen must do something to commit a felony. A citizen can choose to move to Minnesota and by doing so can determine his or her residency, yet another voting requirement. If there is a voter photo ID requirement and there's an issue with the DMV's computer system, even if it's unintentional, the citizen cannot vote. It also means that if a DMV is closed for budgetary reasons, it will no longer be about a driver's license. It will be about providing access to a ballot. Again, unlike other voting requirements, which are controlled by the citizen, this requirement is controlled by those who provide access to the voter photo ID. Since there is no evidence that a voter photo ID will improve the integrity of Minnesota's elections, I urge you to deeply consider the consequences, even the unintentional consequences of a voter photo ID.
Thank you, Mrs. Bonifield. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask, could you please submit a copy of your testimony, if you're able to the committee at some point? I mean, not right now, but...
Yes, I will.
Actually,
thank you.
If any of you would like to do that, that's fine. If you haven't already, it's good testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is John Schwartz. Mr. Schwartz, still here?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Sieben.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask Senator Newman a question, since we've heard a couple testifiers now talk about the challenges of getting supporting documentation to get a state-issued ID. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, how the constitutional question will say the state provide at no charge an approved photographic identification. What are your thoughts on would that also mean that the state would be helping citizens obtain birth certificates or marriage, divorce decrees, things like that?
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sieben, it certainly would if the legislature so dictated.
Again, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman,
Sieben.
I understand that the point of bringing this to a constitutional amendment is to let the subsequent legislature make all of these determinations. But again, I go back to a point I made earlier that isn't it incumbent on us as legislators who are proposing this ballot question to help inform the public about the potential costs and the implications of if this would be enacted?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stephen. Yes, I don't see any reason why any individual associated with the Senate or an elected official would be in any way prohibited from talking to your constituents about the potential costs. I also think that there is testimony that's coming in via a number of testifiers that are bringing up and addressing your concerns.
And perhaps to that point then, Mr. Chair, if council could maybe provide some insight to, I can't remember if the bill last year, which was discussed just in regard to the fiscal note, if that fiscal note accounted for the cost of obtaining birth certificates or supporting documentation.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Council can look into that, and we'll do that. And if you have another question for Senator Newman, otherwise we'll move on to the next testifier.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
If council could have a chance to answer the question, I'd appreciate it.
Council, do you have that information readily available, the cost for...
I believe there was an amendment offered that would require the state to pay those fees. It didn't pass. I don't believe anything in the fiscal note for 509 talked about birth certificates. I'll ask the fiscal analyst. She stepped out for a minute. I'll ask her to take a look at that, and she can get back to us and let us know for sure.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the list is, forgive me for this ahead of time, Kenza from the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kenza Hajmusa, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We're a coalition of over 150 member organizations across the state. Thank you for hearing me speak today. On behalf of thousands of Minnesotans who don't have a home and don't have a current ID, I'm asking you to protect your own constituents' rights to vote. I became passionate about voting rights when I was working at a homeless shelter in Minneapolis. As part of our mission to end homelessness and rebuild lives, staff, volunteers, and shelter residents worked together on a voter engagement project. We registered eligible voters, we talked about voting rights and responsibilities, and we made sure everyone could get to the polls on Election Day who wanted to vote. We talked to hundreds of Minnesotans who are homeless about their voting rights. Some were not interested in voting. They think politicians don't care about them. Others were very, very excited to vote. They went out and spoke to other men and women living in the shelters about how they could register on Election Day and exercise their constitutional right. Being allowed to vote without a place to call home and without a current ID means so much to these Minnesotans who we represent. It gives them faith in their state, and it gives them faith in their elected leaders. It gives them faith in you. Over the years, I've realized just how fair Minnesota's voting laws are. It benefits the whole state. When millionaires vote, when people living on the streets vote, it's saying that we care about ourselves, we care about our community, we care about our future. It's a very, very positive thing that we have in Minnesota. Research has shown that voter impersonation is not a problem. From our perspective, families in rural Minnesota living in their cars in February, that's a problem. Veterans who are coming home from war and living under bridges and on the streets, that's a problem. So as you're deciding today whether or not to move this amendment forward, ask please, who would this amendment help? Who would this amendment hurt? And why is this a priority over jobs and housing?
Thank you very much. It's Hajmusa, mm-hmm. Correct? Any questions? Thank you very much. Senator Sieben? We had, council had an answer to your question regarding the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, I think Krista just talked to you. She's here if you have more questions. But there was nothing in the fiscal note talking about underlying documentation because there was nothing in the bill that would implement that.
Senator
Sieben.
Thank you, Council. And I understand that after speaking with the fiscal analyst, although I think it perhaps we could request a fiscal note on the underlying documentation since Senator Newman said that it's a possibility, if I'm not misquoting you, that that could be addressed in future legislative session or in future enacting legislation. And again, I guess I go back to Senator Newman. If it is your intention to that the state would provide those underlying that underlying documentation, then I guess my point is we need a fiscal note on what that cost would be.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stephen, it is my intention, and I'm going to say this over and over and over again, irrespective of the number of times I'm asked the question, it is my intention that future legislators and the future legislature will address the details of a voter ID bill. It is my intention to move forward on the constitutional amendment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, to press you on this a little bit, but the
Senator Stephen, if I might interject for a moment, the constitutional amendment itself, as Senator Vandeveer pointed out earlier, we can certainly discuss this when legislation is enacted, if it comes to that point. But the constitutional amendment, as it is, isn't requiring expenditures in the current biennium. It's just saying this is what will be required of said date when we adjust the date. But there's nothing to write a fiscal note on.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, if we're proposing to change the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, it would apply to periods beyond this biennium. And it says on lines 1.26 and 1.27 that the state shall provide at no charge an approved photographic identification to eligible voters. So what I'm simply trying to address is what does that language entail? If yes, you may be able to provide, say, similar to the legislation last year, a free state-issued ID to vote, but if it costs an individual anywhere between 50 cents and $60 to obtain the supporting documentation, it's unclear whether the state would be bearing those costs, because that would be a charge that would be required to obtain the approved photographic identification or not. So that's what I'm asking Senator Newman about, his legislative intent here, understanding that it's up to future legislatures to determine some of this.
Well, I hate to belabor the point, but we have many other testifiers like to speak, and they want to speak directly to the constitutional amendment. I'm not saying, nobody is suggesting that your concerns are invalid or they should not be addressed at some point. And we can certainly do that, and it would be done if it came to that. So your points are duly noted, but there's no fiscal note. That has there ever been a fiscal note attached to a constitutional amendment? This would be certainly the first, probably, that I can recall. Nonetheless, we can certainly address your issue. It's valid, but we have other. We've went over this many times. We're addressing just the constitutional amendment. There's a lot of implications in it, but many of those will be taken care of when the legislation is enacted and we take it up. So with that in mind, we'd like to continue with the testimony. Senator Betzel.
I think he left because he thought it was recommencing at 5.
Okay. Oh, okay. Thank you. Then Roberta Bloomster.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good to see you again. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify before you today. My name is Roberta Blomster, and I'm one of the two self-advocate mentors for Merrick, Inc., and currently serving on the ARC Greater Twin Cities Board of Directors, and I do happen to have copies of my testimony. So.
Thank you.
I'm here today to speak against Senate File 1577, which is one of the two voter ID constitutional amendments that was introduced just recently. Voter ID is a very bad idea for the state's disability community. One of the main reasons is that adults with disabilities are having the hardest time with getting and are keeping jobs during this tough economic time. There is a sky-high unemployment rate across this country that has not even been brought up in the news, and it is regarding people with disabilities and jobs, since a lot of businesses don't want to hire us. You are expecting us to pay for the supporting documents needed for the voter ID, but if we are not working, then we won't have the money for the supporting documents such as a birth certificate. Another reason is transportation. How can people with disabilities get to the places that would administer voter ID if they don't drive themselves and they don't have other transportation to fall on, like their family members, metro mobility, etc.? People with disabilities will truly be disenfranchised by this. You will be turning voting from a right to a privilege, and that is what scares the disability community in the state, such as myself. If you want to be preventing something, then you should be working on this one recommendation from the Secretary of State's Disability Advocacy Work Group, of which I'm still serving on, to prevent felons from voting when their sentence is not yet cleared. There should be legislation on this issue so that we are sending a strong message to felons. Don't be voting when you should not be voting. Right behind my testimony is the fact sheet from the ARC Minnesota on their stance against voter ID for some more information. I am open to any questions that you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Blumster. Is there any questions? Any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Next is it Jody and Bo Carlin with Steve Larson, ARC. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson, the Senior Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota, and I'm also co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, which is over 60 organizations, both advocacy and provider organizations. It happens that the ARC is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, and we're very pleased about that. And the ARC concentrates on providing advocacy for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And during that 60 years, the ARC has fought for the rights and for services and supports for persons with disabilities. And one of the rights that we've consistently fought for is the right to vote. Many citizens with disabilities didn't have the right to vote. When you entered a state hospital where many people lived 60 years ago, you had to go under state guardianship and lose your right to vote. So we're very proud of the fact that we've been able, over the years, with the help of the legislature, to restore the right of many citizens with disabilities to vote. Because of that, we're opposed to Senate Pile 1577 because we think it would cause many problems for citizens with disabilities who don't have IDs to vote. Today I was fortunate, as we prepared for testimony here, to find some ARC members that live in Senator Vandeveer's district. So we're sorry that he's not here right now, but we know he can watch this later on his computer. And I'd like to introduce Bo and Carlin and his mother, Jody, who will share their testimony. Bo?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jonathan Bo Carlin. I am a member of Senator Vandeveer District. I am here to ask you to please reject proposal like SF 1577 and our legislations to require voters to have a picture ID. This bill is placed unnecessary roadblock for thousands of Minnesotans with disabilities to exercise their right to vote. I have a ID, Minnesota ID, but I know people who do not. I am lucky. Enough to have a mother who is, able to help me to get it. Some people with disabilities do not have someone to help. Transportation, time, money are all problems for people with disabilities. You need to have them all to get an ID. No Minnesotan should have to pay to exercise their right to vote. It is a right, all?
Yep.
All of our right, okay, our rights as citizens to vote for elected officials and make our voices heard. Please do not make exercising that right more difficult than it already is. Let's focus on jobs instead. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Carlin. Were there any questions? Thank you very much.
My name is Jody Carlin.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And I'm also a member of Senator Vandeveer's district. My son, Bo Carlin, takes his right to vote very seriously. He pays close attention to political matters and is probably one of the most informed voters that I know. As he stated, he's lucky. I'm willing and able to take time off work, unpaid, to help him get his ID. Unfortunately, many people with intellectual disabilities do not have someone to help them. In the interest of time, I will end my testimony here. The rest of my points concerning difficulty of access were covered eloquently by Mr. Chris Powell and others here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carlin. Thank
you. Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Kielash. Yeah, Senator Kielash.
Can I follow that up? Is there an extra burden, I guess, on folks with disabilities that we're not hearing about here as far as both finding transportation, ID, interpreters,
yes,
et cetera, that in this process that we should get a little more in-depth
okay
about?
Would you like to hear the rest of
yes,
it?
Yes, I would. Yeah.
Okay. Put yourself in their shoes. Getting an ID is a complex challenge, arranging for assistance if you need it and can get it, taking one or more days off of work or your day program, since each trip required will take most of your day. Remember, you have to be ready for the bus an hour before pickup and then wait up to an hour to be taken home. That's if the bus is running on time. This does not include drive time, which can be quite significant in outstate. And you will have to save up some money because costs add up fast when, after rent, you have $90 left to live on for the month from your SSI check. Transportation is expensive at $9 plus per round trip. Hopefully you have your Social Security card and birth certificate in your home, or that entails more expensive trips and time. Maybe they are in a safe deposit box, another $9 plus and a day's travel. Since these records for many people with disabilities may have disappeared in the shuffle over the years, maybe a birth certificate or a Social Security card is needed. That is another $9 plus and a day of travel to get to each of these departments, plus $26 for the certificate. That's if all goes well. Have you been to the St. Paul Records Bureau? If things get more complex, more trips, more time, more help is needed, and the expense goes up, your month's $90 will disappear fast. Hope you didn't need a winter coat or a haircut. And, of course, let's hope your ID, which you carry with you everywhere, doesn't get lost or stolen before Election Day.
Mr. Chair. Can I follow up one more time? One of the things that is a little confusing is that because there are folks with disabilities that need to show their ID in order to qualify for disabilities, in other words, their Social Security card or whatever, right? And I'm not sure if the state issues an ID of any kind for a collection of those disabilities, or they're not eligible for the disabilities, they're not eligible for Social Security benefits without being citizens, correct?
That's
so
true.
I'm kind of wondering if we have, is it really necessary for them to go through this whole ID process all over again if their Social Security check just, doesn't that declare them citizens?
And yeah, but it's not a photo ID.
It's not a photo ID. So it does say that they're citizens. They've got the address on their check or whatever that says that they live there. And the only thing that's missing is a photo ID on this,
exactly.
Is what we're saying, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. It seems like we're having them chase an extra ID for...
Very expensive from their point of view, because
yeah,
when you only have $90 and you've got to spend $50 or more to get this thing, if you can find all these pieces.
And we've already declared them citizens, so I mean, it's
exactly.
Not like it's... Thank you.
Ms. Myers? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your names for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gwen Myers, and I thank you for taking time to hear us today.
Closer.
I'm a volunteer lobbyist with the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. The League is a good government organization, as you all know, and volunteering with this organization was a natural step when I retired after 35 years of teaching high school social studies and government. My teaching career and my work with the League has given me enormous respect for our system of government. That includes everything from the United States Constitution right down to township ordinances. It is this respect that urges me today to urge your opposition to adding photo ID language to our state constitution. Election procedures do not belong in our state constitution. Defining procedures for voting, such as how to identify voters at a polling place, is not the function of a constitution. It is a function of law or statutes. Laws can be modified and updated as the technology and methods for voting evolve, as they are in the process of doing. Constitutions are very difficult to change, as we learned when we had to repeal the 18th Amendment on prohibition. A photo ID requirement has no place in our Constitution for an additional reason. Our history is one of expanding voting rights to enable all citizens to vote. From the 18th century, when the right to vote was limited to white male property owners, through the 19th century, when African-American men were enfranchised, into the 20th century, when women gained the vote in 1920, the poll tax was abolished in 1964, and voting age was lowered to 18 in 1971. It has been a proud march to an ever-expanding electorate. Putting the photo ID requirement on our state constitution would be a step backward. Whatever the intentions of the authors of this bill, the Constitution will create barriers to voting for some very specific groups of people, amounting to approximately 11% of the population who do not have government-issued photo IDs. The right of citizens to vote is clearly fundamental to making our democratic system function, and it must be guaranteed. The League of Women Voters, of course, was born out of the 19th Amendment, and we have worked ever since to protect the constitutional rights of all citizens to vote. We believe that the proposed constitutional amendment in Senate File 1577 strikes a blow to that right. We urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Any questions for that witness? Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am the Public Policy Coordinator for League of Women Voters, Minnesota. The League of Women Voters is present in every state in the United States, and the Minnesota League hears from other states about shared issues. We have heard about problems that citizens in other states are encountering in trying to obtain voter IDs in some states that have enacted photo ID requirements. You may have heard some of these stories in the media as well. I would like to share a few examples of real people who have been voting for 40 to 60 years and now face barriers, perhaps insurmountable, because of the photo ID requirement in their states. California native Dolores Freeland now lives in South Carolina, where a new voter ID law was passed. Freeland's mother did not provide a first name on her birth certificate when Freeland was born, and she missed the deadline to add the first name to the birth certificate. Living on disability income, Freeland, age 59, said that she cannot afford to spend the more than $700 to petition a California court to change the name on her birth certificate, and that process could take more than a year. So Freeland does not have the appropriate documents to obtain a photo ID to exercise her right to vote. Closer to home in the state of Wisconsin, two elderly women face barriers in obtaining voter IDs. Florence Hessling is a 96-year-old disabled woman living in Bayfield, Wisconsin. Her driver's license expired a few years ago. To obtain a new state voter ID, Hessling needs a copy of her birth certificate. Hessling was born in Iowa, but when she wrote to the state to obtain a copy of her birth certificate, they informed her that they had no official record of her birth. Without a birth certificate, Hessling cannot obtain a photo ID in Wisconsin to vote. Ruth L. Frank is an 84-year-old woman who lives in Brokaw, Wisconsin. She has never needed a birth certificate until now, when she now needs to obtain one to obtain a voter ID in Wisconsin. But the matter is complicated. The attending physician at her birth misspelled her maiden name on the records that were prepared at the time of her birth. To get a birth certificate with the correct information, she will have to petition a Wisconsin court to amend the document, a process that could take weeks and cost $200 or more. Proponents of photo ID sometimes rely on the Supreme Court decision upholding Indiana's photo ID law, saying that the court could find no one who was denied the right to vote because of the new law. What proponents fail to mention is that the Indiana law was challenged on its face, meaning that no election had taken place since the law had been passed, and the court did not and could not address evidence of real voters encountering problems. So the Indiana court case has nothing to do with how this requirement would work in practice. Rather, these stories that I have shared today show that a photo ID requirement is far from the simple, common-sense measure that proponents have been saying, and that we should learn from those other states' experiences. On behalf of the League of Women Voters Minnesota, I urge you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Senator McGuire, you're a very powerful, persuasive senator, by the way. You got us in this room longer. So.
Mr. Chair, I really do want to thank you for that. And I just, on behalf of the people that are coming here to testify, I really appreciate that you did that. So thank you very much.
Good idea.
Thank you all for all of your testimony. My question is, the League of Women Voters is a very nonpartisan organization, and I know that you care a lot about voting, and I'm assuming you care a lot about that we not have voter fraud. Are you familiar with any voter fraud in Minnesota that this bill is attempting to correct? I mean, I would guess that you might be aware of anything that was happening, of any things that needed changing in our law. I'm just wondering if you know of any
fraud
that's going on.
Senator McGuire and Mr. Chair, we are aware of no problems in the Minnesota election system that a photo ID card would address. The only thing that it can address is voter impersonation, and there is no evidence of that in any Minnesota election.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Representative Kulesh.
Yes. One of my questions has to do with, I know the league also does some training and encouragement of election judges, et cetera, right? And I'm going to lay out just a short scenario, but I think you'd be able to help me with the penalties for this. If in small-town America it happens, Minnesota, it happens all the time, people move from their address down the road into assisted living center after years and years of voting in the same precincts and whatever. They still live in the same precinct, and in many cases they haven't updated their ID. If that person then goes to the polls and is recognized by the election judge, because that election judge is maybe even a relative that's grown up with her, had been in the same small town her whole life, knows who that person is, it cannot be anybody else, knows that they've lived there and voted there their entire life, but because that senior did not get a new voter new photo ID with their address on it, what would the penalty be for that election judge to allow their mother to vote?
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
isn't that kind of what we're talking about here? Even though you know that person is who they are,
you're speaking as though this thing has passed.
Yes.
And we have in that case, the election judge would have to turn the person away. Now, what the penalty would be might be specified in the new law, but the election judge could not do that. Today, of course, that person would simply use same-day registration to change
right.
your address, and she'd be in like Flynn. But with the new law, that person would have to be turned away.
The current law that doesn't – that election judge is not allowing somebody to vote that doesn't have the current information or whatever or not registered. Isn't there a penalty for that currently under the law, and wouldn't that be the same? A misdemeanor,
yeah,
gross misdemeanor.
I really have no idea.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Ms. Jules Goldstein. Mister. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Jules Goldstein. And the last time I testified before this committee was in 1969. And the committee was chaired by Senator Popp. Among the members of the committee at that time were Senators Sinclair, Rosenmeyer, Coleman, and Perpich, Rudy. Mm-hmm. I'm a little rusty. As it is, I testified on a constitutional amendment affecting this section of the Constitution. At the time, I was the senior lobbyist for the Minnesota Coalition to Lower the Voting Age. I think it might have even been in this room, although it is a new carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there were no women on the committee because there were no women in the Senate. That may be one of the effects of lowering the voting age. My intention to speaking here was to deal with the same issue, the rights of youth to vote, because I've still got my notes from 1969. But there are people who preceded me in line who spoke adequately on that, so there are a few other things I would like to talk about in the time available. I think there is a flaw in the law. It's been partially improved by putting in an effective date, but should the constitutional amendment pass and should the next legislature have the same success as the last one in passing such a law, we would be in a situation where nobody could vote in 2013. It is important that the rule be amended so that there also be a qualification that not take effect till at least 1 year after the enacting legislation is passed or there's other problems. I'm not concerned about believe that the section on identical rules would mean that the least imposing rules would apply, which means that it would mean that registering at an election office would then follow the same standards as same-day registration, not the other way around. Identical is identical, and it would, so the loosest ones would seem to apply. A few years ago, I came in contact with a pickpocket. It happened in the beginning of November. I quickly had all of my credit cards changed. I quickly applied for a new driver's license and walked around for 2 weeks with a paper form till the new one arrived with my picture on it. As it was, there was an election in between. Had this been in effect, not only would the thief had stolen my wallet, he would have stolen my right to vote, because there is no exception for someone who to obtain a replacement one in short order. And I'm not sure how to fix the law, the amendment to improve that, but there should be some provision, because things will happen at the last moment. And I have one other point to make. The language for eligible voters being provided with a photo ID at the expense of the state seems to say that in order to get a photo ID, you have to have a photo ID, because you can't be an eligible voter until that point. And so there should be something to make sure that language is clear. I think you're almost there on that, but the verbiage should be improved in that. Those are the points I wanted to make. Are there any questions?
Any questions for the witness?
Excuse me. Could you clarify the language that you thought the amendment needed changed on that? I think it was for voters. No charge to the voters, was it?
The provision, and I'm working off the language from that was printed on the 27th, and so it might have changed in the new language that was read today. But it says that the state shall provide at no charge identifications to eligible voters.
Right.
But it seems that the first section, as far as establishing who is an eligible voter, requires a photographic ID. And so it needs to make sure that does not apply. And I think that adding the language as far as presents valid photographic identification as prescribed by law almost does it, but it must be clear that you don't need to be able to provide that in order to get the photo ID from the state. And I'm not sure that's the case in the language.
Okay, thank you.
I can see why all those other senators liked you. Good job. Okay, our next, Susie, Ms. Brown, are you here today? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
My name is Susie Brown. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits is a 2,000-member diverse statewide group of nonprofit organizations. We include food shelves, educational institutions, long-term care facilities, early childhood centers, arts institutions, homeless shelters, healthcare systems, and many others. We are strictly nonpartisan, as is our membership, which spans a wide spectrum of views. I expect many, if not all of you, have volunteered at your local nonprofit organizations, or perhaps served in leadership positions on their boards of directors, or certainly made contributions to support the work of the nonprofits that reflect your values and vision for the community. So we thank you for your partnership with the nonprofit community. An important role for our community-based nonprofit organizations is promoting civic participation. These institutions are uniquely positioned to do so for two key reasons. They're based on a foundation of volunteerism, and they have unique relationships with many members of the community. First of all, they're based on a foundation of volunteerism, whether volunteering to read to children, serve on a board of directors, make an annual contribution. All of these acts of community engagement bring the voice and values of Minnesota citizens to addressing the issues facing their communities. Voting is an extension of this. It's the most basic act of community engagement, and it's a critical start for broader civic engagement. Nonprofits also have unique relationships with many people who are not yet voters. In the spirit of promoting community engagement, we support our member organizations in providing nonpartisan information and encouragement to vote to those who access their services. They could be homebound seniors, new citizens, highly mobile or homeless people, young adults, and many others, as you've heard from many nonprofits today. We recognize that for many of our member organizations, it is precisely those with whom they are in daily contact who would be most impacted by this constitutional amendment. We recognize that Minnesota has an incredible track record of voting participation, and we know that there's room to improve. The problem that should be solved in our election system today is closing the gap of 700,000 people, as we heard from the Secretary of State's office, and ensuring a full participation of eligible voters in Minnesota. Every day, nonprofit organizations work towards solving that problem. Our goal is to work with community-based institutions to reduce barriers to voting and both maintain and increase voting as an act of community participation. We know that strong communities depend on actively engaged citizens, and our community institutions, the government, your institution, and nonprofits, ours, count on robust civic participation. We look forward to working with the legislature on bipartisan election reforms, which are designed to increase voter participation, maintain multiple channels of access to voting, and reduce barriers to full participation of Minnesota's citizens in our elections. We recognize that this proposed amendment achieves exactly the opposite effect, creating additional requirements and a one-size-fits-all model that threatens to erect very real barriers for both long-time and new voters who are our constituents in the nonprofit sector. For those reasons, we oppose this amendment, and we encourage you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Brown? Okay. Mr. Tom Diamond, you. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Tom Diamond. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I think the first point is, why is this being done? It's really the crux of the issue. So many of you come from different experiences and backgrounds. In my experience and background in my community, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about. And I don't see how this applies to my community. I've had the opportunity to volunteer to do a lot of voter registration, to help take people to the polls, been involved in recounts, been involved in activity with the polls. And I have never seen voter fraud, never heard of it, never discussed. And I have not heard any testimony today of people having that sort of activity in their district. And if that is true in other parts of the state, I would hope that information would be brought to the table so we could address that as a fact. But I've certainly not seen it in my community. What I have seen in my community, in my experience, is disenfranchised people. That really, I think, is the heart of the issue if we're talking about protecting voters, is disenfranchisement. I'll give you some examples of that. One is, if you take a look, there is very clear record. While there isn't a record of fraud, there is very clear record of disenfranchisement. You can take and look at the statistics that are kept by the counties in the state, and you will see that there is very significant percentage drop-offs depending on the communities. Identical populations, but difference, but the vote drops off. And there's a number of factors for that. But some of them, and I'll give you an example, what was talked about by Senator Sieben. And that is, if you take a look at St. Paul, some of our school districts have a 90% transient rate. It's pretty astounding, but it's true. What that means is 90% of the students who start there in the year are not there at the end of the year. And those are tied to families. So it gives you an idea of the churn in these neighborhoods and the instability in these neighborhoods. As Senator Sieben mentioned before, the issue of, now if you're requiring these people to get these updated and to the correct address, You can imagine the burden that falls on these individuals to no fault of their own. And again, I think if you take a look at how does this apply to different populations and does the burden fall differently on different population groups? And I think in my community, it very much would fall more heavily on it. These are families that many times they're working two to three low-wage jobs just to try and make ends meet. And to put another burden on them is just going to drive down the ability for them to participate in the electoral process. We've seen it, we've personally seen it, and know of it, and the records show it. Another one of the groups that it impacts is seniors, and I won't repeat some of the points that were raised earlier, but two of the points that I would like to bring up, having dealt with this both personally with parents and family members, and I think many of you probably recognize it too, is that besides some of the other challenges, when you go to help your seniors, the people who raised you up, they have a great deal of pride, and they have a great deal of privacy. And so trying to assist them to get records, birth records, various other records, and what it is, can be very challenging because they want to protect their dignity. And so the impacts on seniors is greater than other parts of the population. Another group that, as a veteran, I've had a fair amount of experience with, is veterans have a number of challenges that directly relate to their service for this country. PTSD is one of the ones that is talked about quite a bit. And the impacts to that, I've dealt with quite a few family members and others who have challenges with maintaining sobriety and other physical and plain physical limitations, injuries that have directly related to their service for this country. Once again, they are a population that are disproportionately impacted by additional requirements to vote in. And if all these groups, I can't say that vets have any more right to vote as anybody else because they don't, but they certainly deserve a right to vote. And every opportunity and any hurdle that is put in their way, I just think is wrong. And then finally, just to wrap it up, it's only at the Capitol, I think, that you can have a statement that it's only going to cost a mere $2.5 to $4 million to try and implement this program. Well, respectfully, when you talk about the needs of our seniors, our veterans, voter registration, I would suggest that that money can be put to much better use elsewhere in our society. And I would thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Are there any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Amy McDonough. Welcome.
Thank
please
you.
State your name.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Amy McDonough from AARP, and I have copies of my testimony here for the committee members.
Thank you.
AARP is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization dedicated to addressing the needs of interests of Americans age 50 and older. We have 39 million members across the country and 650,000 right here in Minnesota. We're very concerned that a constitutional amendment on voter ID, if passed, could hamper the ability of many older Minnesotans to vote. And we've heard a lot of testimony about this today, so I'll make it brief. A new photo ID would disproportionately affect older voters because we know that they're substantially less likely to have the required identification. A national statistic says that about 1 in 5 citizens over 65 lack a current government-issued photo ID. If Minnesota enacts a photo ID requirement in the Minnesota Constitution, most of us, if we're lucky and able-bodied, will be able to use our current driver's license, and it's not a big deal to most of us. However, if We live in a society where many people over 65 have obviously given up their driving privileges, and they've also given up their driver's license, and very few have replaced it with a photo ID. And for many, it will be very difficult to obtain the right documentation. We've heard from many of our members that they were born before recording births was even standard procedure. While the ID itself might be free, voters, especially women, will have to purchase copies of birth certificates, marriage licenses, divorce decrees, and other documents to show name changes. We're also very concerned about the elderly who may find themselves in transition in the months or weeks just prior to Election Day. For many older Minnesotans, a move to a new facility or a one-story apartment after a health care crisis is the only move that they've made after living in their own homes for decades. This is a very stressful time in a senior's life, and those without help from family members will struggle to find the right documentation in order to vote. AARP believes that the right to vote is the most basic of all political rights. Older individuals from all political affiliations vote in disproportionately high numbers. And we have long advocated for fair and simple procedures that facilitate this high level of participation. We believe that we must maintain important voting tools in Minnesota's system, and we must take into account the needs of older voters and those with disabilities. An amendment to the Constitution would put these rights at risk, and we urge you to oppose this effort. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Hey, Tom Ferber. Mr. Ferber, are you still in the room, or? Deborah Mangan? Deborah Mangan? How about Jeff Johnson?
Yes, sir.
Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Thank you. I am Major Jeffrey L. Johnson. I am a resident of Shoreview, Minnesota. Senator Chamberlain happens to be my representative before this committee. And I am grateful that all of you have adjusted your schedule so that we could continue with the testimony this afternoon, because I think this proposed piece constitutional amendment to our Constitution is important to discuss and take a look at. As closely as we can. Now, I know that originally I was placed on the list to testify today as a member of the Democratic Party's Veterans Caucus. I, however, was just informed about coming over to testify today, so please take these remarks that I'm making today as my own, as I have not had an opportunity to go over what my testimony would be with the Veterans Caucus. Do, however, please note that I have some experience, like Jules mentioned earlier, before this committee. I have over 40 years' experience in working on voter participation issues, dating back to my being one of the principals in the Minnesota Coalition to Lower the Voting Age, as we lobbied before the state legislature to lower the voting age to 19. I might point out that that amendment not only was incredibly clear in its language, it had the support of over 50 major state organizations and was principally supported by the veterans organizations. Shortly after the 1970 election, I became the co-chair of the Minnesota Youth Franchise Coalition. We in turn lobbied before the state of Minnesota for passage of the federal 18-year-old voting age amendment. And I'm happy to say that Minnesota was the first state not only to pass it, but the first state to deliver a certified copy of that to the United States Capitol, courtesy, quite frankly, of a corporate jet provided by Honeywell. Following that, I was appointed to the White House Conference on Youth 1971, where I was the Secretary of the Task Force on Legal Rights and Justice. And there, the Nixon administration asked me to speak on behalf of the lowering the voting age to 18 in the federal amendment, which I traveled throughout the country to do. When I returned to Minnesota following that, I became the president of the Minnesota Youth Citizenship Fund. We were a 501c3 foundation, and we were the first organization outside of the League of Women Voters to actively engage in voter registrations throughout the state as we implemented our new law at that time requiring cities over a population of 10,000 to then in turn require voter registration. Subsequent to that, I began my services in the Army. I spent over 24 years. After being an enlisted man for 6 years, I became a commissioned officer in the regular Army for the remainder. And in those duties, I was a voter assistance officer at Fort Lewis, Washington, and Fort Benning, Georgia, at the company, battalion, and brigade level, in infantry units, by the way. Finally, from 1987 to 1990, I was the installation voting assistance officer at an overseas military base in Daegu, Korea. And as a result, I think I have a number of things that I can offer to you with some level of expertise as to the construction of this piece, of this Constitution Amendment as it's currently written. And I'm going to do my darndest not to label this with any verbiage of ill-conceived or poorly worded or whatever. So if you catch me in doing that, allow me to apologize in advance, because that is not my intent this afternoon. The problem I have, and I'm going to go line by line with the verbiage that is currently included in this legislation and just point out areas of concern that I have and that I think that this committee should have, because if it's not done here, it may not happen before the voters. Constitutional amendments, by their very nature, use language that can never be specific enough as to legislative intent, current law as it's interpreted. And I might point out, as it was pointed out to me before this committee and before the House equivalent committee in 1968 and 69, it is the law that is enforced when the legislation is passed and the court decisions therein. Enabling legislation can clarify that, but it becomes more difficult, and hence the terminology that you choose has to be very carefully constructed indeed. Let's begin with line 1.6 that's before us right now. I just might point out where it talks about being a citizen of the United States. It's an interesting concept. You may not be aware, but when we were first a state, beginning in 1858, do you realize that we did not require citizenship to vote in the state of Minnesota? It was not a requirement. In fact, you could be the equivalent of today's resident alien and declare that you were intended to become a citizen and be permitted to vote in this state. So it's interesting of the kind of the history. As we get down to line 1.7, it then continues on with being a citizen of the United States for 3 months. Now, I will very much admit and point out to the committee, yes, the right to vote is not one of our enumerated rights. That's one of the reasons why it can be taken away. It's one of the reasons why it can be restricted. I find it curious that we chose 3 months. You can argue, why not a year, why not 6 months? You can also argue, why not the day before this law, the 30 days it's proposed here, or the day of the election. I just might also add, it would be incredibly difficult for me to look a military veteran in the face who became a citizen as a result of his or her military service and then tell that individual that, well, you became a citizen yesterday, but it wasn't 90 days before, so it doesn't count. But, oh, by the way, I guess your disability and the disfigurement doesn't count. Yes, Senator.
Yes, Mr. Johnson, I understand you have great experience in this field, but you're addressing language that really, I appreciate the history, but you're addressing language that's already been written in the Constitution some time ago. I am interested, however, really interested in what you think about the language that Senator Newman has proposed. And
I am going from the legislation as proposed, and I'm using your terms, but I'm trying to point out the shortcomings in the language chosen.
Well, the language that Senator Newman has chosen is the underlined stuff. That's the language that he's proposing. Okay.
Well,
just for clarification. Thank you.
I did not perhaps fully understand that.
Members, I just want to make a brief announcement real quick here, is that we are not going to vote on this today. We have a number of members that have conflicts in their schedule. So we'll be finishing up, we hope, with the public testimony, and then we'll work on it next meeting. Thank you. Go ahead.
Right. Allow me to continue with line 1.7. The term resided. That and the term residency, which will appear a couple times further on in the language, is perhaps a loaded term. I might point out that it is possible, in fact, in the case of personnel and their spouses serving on active duty in the military, that your place of residence may not, in fact, be the place where you properly should be voting from. Nor is it, in this language, used the term home of record, which could possibly be yet another place where you could properly be voting from. I'm a Dynabrat. All those years that I was in the military, could I have voted or should I have voted in the precinct of my parents in Edina? Or should I have been voting in Bemidji, where I was assigned as an Army ROTC officer, or countless other locations? Going on that same line, 1.7, a requirement of 30 days. I would recommend that the committee have its legal counsel check the United States Supreme Court ruling in Keppel versus the United States.
Mr. Johnson, you're talking about the current Constitution.
Sir, I'm talking about a court ruling called Keppel of the United States. I believe it requires only 20 days.
1.6 and 1.7 are currently in the Constitution.
Well, then it's only because someone hasn't sued to perhaps make that change. I believe the court ruling is 20 days. At the time of voting, it's an interesting concept, especially in terms of where someone, in fact, might reside at the time of voting, and it's going to greatly affect that, as is the term on 1.9 prescribed by law. I might point out to you that we have state as well as federal law, and in some cases, we have laws that are appropriate to other jurisdictions. I'll drop down one more line to 1.10. Identical eligibility. I understand the intent, but I might point out that I believe we already have, and I don't believe a constitutional amendment to the state of Minnesota's constitution can change the fact that we, and by law in this country, have several classes of voters. That is very much driven by not only the laws that we have currently in place and enacted regarding military personnel and their voting, but regular civilian citizens who live in overseas locations. They are also covered by pertinent federal law. I would, on 1.11, again, as far as practicable, there's an awful lot of interpretation that can go to that term. You can probably drive a truck through it, whether you're in favor of this piece of legislation or if you're opposed to it. Also, I would allow me to point out on 1.12 the term registration. I believe there are federal laws covering military personnel and overseas civilians as well as others regarding the use of federal forms, federal qualifications, and so on to, in fact, register to vote. Allow me to drop down to line 1.16. I think the intent here is clear, and I don't know that many of us would object to it, but I would point out the term convicted of a felony. Are we talking about a felony as it is recognized in the state of Minnesota by the federal government? Or are we going to use perhaps the state of Colorado, where if you photograph farm operations or beef cattle operations.
Mr. Johnson, that area is not a subject of this hearing, though. That's currently.
Very good. But I'll just continue on. I'll just point out again, as we go on there, you've got pratfalls that are hidden in this doggone thing, whether or not you're going to consider it or not. 1.17, the term guardianship. Are you aware that besides Minnesota guardianships, you have federal guardianships, and you have guardianships that are established by the Veterans Administration, some of which are administrative in nature and are not adjudicated? Similarly, is it your intent, Senator, that this the term insane be adjudicated as being insane or done so by an administrative court?
Mr. Johnson, it doesn't matter what his intent is. It's not in his bill.
Oh, but it does.
It's not as, is it's already current law.
And I will stand before you. I understand what you're trying to do. I'm just trying to also point out that the verbiage that you have selected for language in this amendment.
The voters already
is
adopted
a trap.
This language that you're talking about, and it was already adopted by the legislature and the voters. So.
And I'll also caution you that if you take this as written, or quite painfully, probably any such amendment of this nature before the public, the misinformation, the misunderstanding, and the outright lies that will be perpetrated in the course of that election will be utterly fantastic. That concludes my testimony. I will attempt to prepare this and write it and answer whatever questions you have, please.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for
Mr. Chair? Yeah, because of your expertise in the military I guess you made some reference to the identical eligibility verification standards and all of that. Could you just elaborate on how this may fall short of meeting federal election laws, or is it military election laws? Or
federal election laws.
Federal election laws.
And I might point out, by the way, they recently changed within the last two or three years, and I retired in 1995, so some of the difficulties that are out there. One is establishing your residency. For example, when I left Bemidji, Minnesota, I then transferred to Daegu, Korea. I had rented a house in Bemidji. That was no longer my residence. Where am I to vote from? My home of record at my parents' home in Edina? I don't have an answer for that. Also, the type of identification to be used. a driver's license in many states may be, in fact, out of date and yet still be valid and enforced for the privilege of driving because you are in the military and not required to renew it or keep the address up to date. Military personnel, when they deploy overseas, not just to a war zone, but to a peacetime military fort, oftentimes will arrive, pick up a new mailing address, which will not match anything that was a previous residence, obviously, not match any type of identification that they have. Now, under the federal law, the voting assistance officer has generally been at the unit level, and they're able to go to the official unit records, personnel records, of the service member and their spouse. It's also entered electronically in a system called DEERS, D-E-E-R-S, where it can be then validated.
Can I follow up, Mr. Senator? And that, because you've helped vets register to vote in states when they are stationed in that, I'm just curious as to is there military ways of validating that they can indeed vote in Minnesota or Georgia or any place else that they choose? And how
I
is that?
I thank you for asking that question because the difficulty, in fact, of enforcing the various state laws, we found to be utterly impossible. As a result, that's one of the reasons why the various federal laws allowing for military personnel, their spouses, and other overseas civilians to use the federal system to register and to request absentee ballots.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Senator Kielash, I can, all deference to Mr. Johnson, but I was in the military too, and I was in the military while this Constitution, less the underlying language, was and Senator Reinhart as well. And I had no trouble voting absentee. We have absentee laws that in Minnesota, I can't speak for Georgia, of course, but in Minnesota, we've had absentee laws that have protected veterans and their voting rights, absentee voting rights. And so I've done it, and I know we have provisions to protect their
and
rights.
And I would share your observation. But interestingly enough, it was on C-SPAN on Sunday afternoon, a half an hour show, which you could probably call up on the internet and play back. It's only half an hour long, as they had a conference talking about military voting and so on. About 85% of military personnel and their spouses are currently registered to vote. A very substantial portion of those members and their spouses, in fact, do vote or at least attempt to cast one. And there's the dispute about how many of those people, in fact, become disenfranchised due to technicalities of one form or another. There's also a dispute about the numbers because the two systems that are used to count them are using different methods and are producing different numbers. But the fact of the matter remains, yes, most states, certainly Minnesota, has been very good about providing the absentee ballot. I don't know what this will do, and this is just pure conjecture, which is not in the legislation that's proposed. It would end up being in the enabling legislation. But if we go to a provisional ballot, that's a different ball of wax entirely. I don't know how you would meet what are customarily the interpretations of a provisional ballot where you're presenting yourself for someone of competent authority prior to receiving that ballot. I might also point out that we have difficulties in absentee ballots being counted, and it was only recently that we were able to change the Minnesota law. We had the special envelope that they were put in, but we allow military personnel to download and print out a military ballot and mail it back in. which doesn't go in an envelope to be validated by the registrar in a similar fashion. Finally, just as a last aside here, my own personal experience in 1988 and 1990, while I was in Korea, my wife and I did our darndest to vote absentee. Our ballots arrived roughly 2 weeks before the election. In order to get them here, I paid about $103 each to FedEx them. When I returned to Minnesota, I went down to the registrar's office and asked if they had a record of my ballots being received and counted. When I described having FedExed them back, I was told by the registrar, of course they were not accepted, nor were they counted. The law requires that you use first-class U.S. mail.
Wow.
I just caution, be very careful in the language, regardless of your intent.
Mr. Chair, it's unique, I think a somewhat unique witness, and I just wanted to, because you also mentioned there's other people other than military personnel overseas, and with all the Fortune 500 international companies here, there are many Minnesota citizens that are serving those countries overseas, and the I think that's where you run into this identical eligibility verifications for them to be able to vote in the state, even though they're you know, doing service.
It's interesting you bring that up.
So,
we traveled over and on Northwest Airlines flight with a family from the metropolitan area here. He was an exec for 3M. He went to staff their office in Seoul. And equally, their tenure was the exact same time we flew back together in 1990. They also noted the same difficulty of having to FedEx their absentee ballots.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good discussion. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Betzold, I notice you're back. Care to come up and address the committee?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's good to be back. I am also going to talk briefly on my name is Donald Betzold, and I'm a retired Army officer. I'm a retired colonel, 4 years on active duty and 26 years in the reserves. And I just wanted to briefly address some of the points on the military voting that the previous witness had talked about. I'm not representing anybody but just my own personal views, but obviously the law that we're considering, it may impact you know, many voters overseas in the military and their dependents. In my case, I was overseas for 4 years on active duty. I had a vote by absentee ballot, and I did not have a need for a Minnesota identification card. Minnesota driver's license did me no good overseas because I had to qualify for an overseas, in this case, a European driver's license. I didn't need it for identification purposes. It would have been outdated anyway because the address that would have been on my driver's license wouldn't have matched where I was living overseas. Plus, I was over for 4 years, so even having a Minnesota driver's license would have expired during that time period. And as I say, this affects not only military members, but their dependents and also civilians as well, too. Now, I realize that the language before you addresses some issues that would be addressed by a future legislature if passed. Of course, we don't know the membership of a future legislature, but I do know one thing for sure, and that's that whatever is embedded into the Constitution would trump any statute if there's any vagueness. And so I hope that the members of any future legislature will be very careful to take these into account, because if this is to be read as to requiring a Minnesota identification, the military identification card does not specify a state. And that could very well affect members of the armed services from Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members, that's all I've got. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Bell?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, would that, if we had a requirement for a Minnesota ID, would that be in violation of the U.S. And you had a military ID, that would that be in violation? Do we need to include that in anything we do in the future?
Well, I don't know, again, how courts would rule on something like that. But if the courts were to say that the Minnesota Constitution was amended to require a Minnesota identification, the courts could construe that to require a Minnesota identification. Yes, an overseas member, you know, could have a driver's license, an outdated driver's license. Is it valid anymore? There'd be a lot of questions that would be raised on that. And I'm just bringing up those issues for people that can't come back home to vote and can't come back home to get a valid and or renew their license.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Betzel, this says valid photographic identification as prescribed by law. That couldn't be construed too easily misconstrued if you wrote a statute and included military IDs legislation we had did. Yeah. Senator Betzel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, that may be true, but I don't know what the words of some future statute is going to say, and neither does anybody here. And if the words and the intent of the voters seem to be to some court that it requires a Minnesota identification, and, you know, I'm just trying to project in the future what it would mean, that could have the effect of disqualifying people who do not have a Minnesota identification. And in the case of service members, they wouldn't need one. So I'm just cautioning you that there's some issues down the road that people have to keep in mind to make sure that we don't goof it up.
Senator Betzel, in order to deal with that argument, we'd have to put it in here, right in here, unless the next legislature screws it up.
Well,
I don't think we've done that on other
there's always constitutional there's
amendment.
Always a first time, Mr. Chair. You know,
there certainly is, but that's
and it's not like the legislature's never screwed up before either.
Well, that's a good point. That's your best point all day. Thank you for coming.
Senator Betzel, it's good to see you. And you have had some good experience here at the Capitol, and you've probably been around for a few other constitutional amendments, although I might say we don't have very many constitutional amendments because, thank heavens, the legislature, I think, is very careful to not put too many things in our Constitution that we really should be legislating. So I'm just wondering if you're, as you've been listening to the testimony, because I know that you've been here for most of the day, and reading this language, would you say that many of our answers have been, we'll put that in statute. Well, that will be in statute. That will be in statute. I'm just wondering what your opinion is of that, putting – I understand a lot of this does need to be in statute, and I actually like the whole thing to be in statute. I don't want any of it. I'm nervous about it being in the Constitution this way because it feels, very vague, and it needs a lot of work at this point. So I'm just wondering what your impression is.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a prerogative, obviously, this committee, the legislature. My concern right now is just how it might affect military members. I know you've heard a lot of testimony throughout the day, and you've had various points of view. I just wanted to point out this one area, and I'll be certainly happy to discuss with anybody my views on it. But I think you're well informed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Ginger Hedstrom. Ms. Hedstrom.
Mr. Chair.
Sister Hedstrom. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're a long way away in this committee room.
It's way over. Further away. I have a question about the definition of valid. And it probably goes without saying that valid means one that is currently valid. But would an expired driver's license be considered a valid photo identification as prescribed by law?
Would that be a question for the author? Senator?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, my apologies. I was writing and I didn't hear the question.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, my question is, and I think I know the answer, but does valid mean that it has to be a currently valid photographic identification, or could an expired but yet still valid identification, or at one point it was valid, be considered a I guess my question is, what's the definition of valid? It has to be currently valid?
Mr. Chairman.
Can it be expired?
Yeah, Senator Sieben, I think that your question goes directly to the portion of the bill that leaves to the legislature that determination. I understand perfectly what, for instance, former Senator Betzold's concerns were about military personnel, and possibly they would be dealing with a driver's license, for instance, that is now expired. I just don't believe that this amendment in any way would prohibit the legislature from addressing the concerns of providing the ability of military personnel, whether they be in the United States or overseas, or our citizens working overseas, the ability to vote. So in answer to your question, I think that we have to go directly to the part of the bill that talks about as prescribed by law. The future legislature is going to determine what is a valid identification.
I think, too, wouldn't you say, Senator Newman, that if the reason for not doing a constitutional amendment was that the next legislature might not implement it correctly, then we couldn't do any? Because that's always a possibility, and it's their job to be careful and not to make mistakes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would assume that if the people of the state of Minnesota adopt a constitutional amendment, that the legislature in Minnesota and its elected officials would abide by the directive of the people. I mean, I will tell you that I am assuming that through the course of coming forward with this bill. I'm honestly not aware of any instance in the history of the state of Minnesota where the people of this state adopted a constitutional amendment and their representatives and their senators ignored it. I mean, I'm just not aware of that at all.
Okay. Ms. Hedstrom, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ginger Hedstrom. And today I represent the Immigration Legislative Advocacy Partners and Nonpartisan Get Out the Vote Working Groups of the Justice Commission of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet and Consociates. We express our deep concern for the citizens of Minnesota who may be marginalized by this legislation, particularly Minnesotans who are elderly, disabled, homeless, living in temporary shelters, and college students, as we have heard throughout the afternoon. This bill has the potential to unnecessarily render student ID, military ID, and U.S. passports invalid. Regarding impact on the elderly, approximately 125 Elder Sisters of St. Joseph moved 2 months ago from Bethany Convent to Carondelet Village, a senior living community here in St. Paul. These women are community leaders with a strong commitment to civic responsibility and engagement. The constitutional amendment would create incredible barriers and burdens for them because many have not had a driver's license or a state ID, and most do not have current driver's license or IDs. I know from my work with and for them that their citizenship and their right to vote are as crucial as their every breath. While I cannot speak for all elders in Minnesota, those living in senior centers or other senior living facilities, or all elders, we do know from a study at the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that approximately 25% of aging persons across the country do not have a current driver's license. From our perspective, this bill does not solve problems, but rather has the potential to create a mountain of them. Lastly, as we consider the economic crisis that Minnesota faces, we oppose SF1577, which is predicted to cost millions to implement and in the process marginalize thousands of eligible voters. This bill will address voter impersonation only, of which to date there have been zero cases convicted in the state of Minnesota. We oppose this bill from a moral and an economic perspective, and we urge you to vote against it as well. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Questions for the witness? Seeing none. Thank you. David Green, please. David Green. Your name for the tape, please. And
yes. My name is David Green. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I am a member of the Basilica of St. Mary, and I'm also a computer engineer over at Cray Incorporated, just about a mile from here. And I want to start out by relating a story about my grandmother, who passed away about a year and a half ago. She encountered, you know, she was in the situation of many of the elderly that we've heard about this afternoon. She never had an ID her entire life, as far as I know. Never drove, never handled the family finances. But she told us a story repeatedly about growing up in Elk River. And I think she told it because she was proud of her father, but also as a lesson to us of how we should live in community together. And the story went something like this. My great-grandfather owned a harness shop in Elk River. And there were, at the time, a lot of immigrants coming to the state and setting up their farms, actually much like today. And immigrants maybe didn't speak so English so well or not at all. And it happens there were some unscrupulous bankers at the time who would offer mortgages to these immigrants and not tell them about their tax obligations. And the bankers would hope that the immigrants would not pay their taxes, they would forfeit their land, the bank could pay the back taxes and acquire the land back dirt cheap. Well, my great-grandfather would go around every year around tax time. He'd go around to his neighbors, and he'd tell them, well, you better pay your taxes. You know, here's what's going to happen if you don't pay your taxes. And he didn't ask for their papers. He didn't question their patriotism. He didn't look less on them because of the color of their skin or because they didn't have a lot of money. He just thought, we're all a family in Minnesota. We should treat each other that way. And I tell this story because we've heard this afternoon that there are a lot of people that have barriers in getting IDs and complying with the law. Why are we making it harder for people to participate in society? And as a person of faith, I was somewhat curious about, you know, what do the biblical prophets have to say about this? And I think it's fair to say that this proposed amendment, the effect would be to lower the number of people eligible to vote. I don't think it will increase the number of people eligible to vote. So I was looking through my Bible last night, and I have it here. It's a little worn. And somewhat to my surprise, it turns out that this issue is actually directly covered. And so I'll just read that passage from Isaiah chapter 10. If I can find it here, give me a moment. So Isaiah chapter 10, here we go. It says, "Woe to those who enact unjust statutes, who write oppressive decrees, depriving the needy of judgment and robbing my people's poor of their rights, making widows their plunder and orphans their prey. What will you do on the day of punishment when ruin comes from afar? To whom will you flee for help? Where will you leave your wealth, lest it sink beneath the captive or fall beneath the slain? For all this, his wrath is not turned back. His hand is still outstretched." Now, I think there's a lot of us in this room who profess to actually believe what's in these books. And if we do,
I think we better very seriously consider what we're talking about doing in this room today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Thank you for coming. Mr. Richard Heller? Richard Heller? Do you state your name for the record, please? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak, Chair Ray and Co-Chair Roger. My name is Rick Heller. I reside in Minnesota, have for my whole life. I'm currently unofficially representing two groups in Minnesota right now that really haven't been identified clearly. They're called Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled. I appreciate this time tonight with the local government elections and their members and the chair again and co-chair with this House File 1577. I will make my recommendation as follows. Since I make it a point to understand some principles based on universal design that is actually related to this, believe it or not, as Ms. Wolf understands this very well, one of the representatives of a child I know in a district. And it's called Universal Design for Learning, the What, How, and Why of Learning. Why of learning is about motivation, engagement, and participation in a system. In this process here today regarding elections, when I don't see certain triggers in place or delays of how to start such a system to solve this problem as it relates to ages, the types of services such as one gentleman mentioned about military, felons, as you know, likely part of the print disabled, as you know, if you want to look it up, print disabled is found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008. And by the way, universal design is defined in, defined in there. Also, as mentioned tonight, we talk about the homeless, we talk about dropouts in the education system, we talked about the disabled, and those are at risk. And when we talk also about the age barriers, the high and low ends, including perhaps as we get into an aging group of individuals, the baby boomers, as you know, medical related, how does that play a role in this when it comes also to the final end, the cost? When we really don't know a cost, is it really fair to the people at large that I have mentioned, appropriate to pass such a bill? Including these temporary permits without pictures. Once again, without the means of flexibility in something such, by the way, if you look up innovative design, it's all about flexibility and having those principles in place. When you're very rigid, that will not make it happen. Please consider this third item. As you know, both parties are somewhat neutral on currently on the federal level regarding immigration laws. That's a piece I haven't heard about tonight. Also, you may, if it's still going to happen, you may also think about national ID system. You know, that's been in a discussion as well. Or you may even check with Homeland Security. Last but least, if this has to happen, I would ask you to reach across the table in a bipartisan way and perhaps put picture IDs on the election ballot. Thank you for this opportunity tonight.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? See none. Randy Liebel? Mr. Liebel, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
You got to talk right in it, I think.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
My name is Randy Lebo. I'm with one of the state leaders of the Tea Party Patriots in the state of Minnesota, and I'm here to speak in favor of the voter ID law. And I guess where I would start with this is saying, if we go back to the 2008 election, we had about 6,000 people who voted, who when we returned their registration cards, they were same-day registrants. Those 6,000 came back and said that there was nobody present at that address. Some of them turned out to be warehouses. Some of them turned out to be but the person who registered to vote didn't have a valid place on their on the same day registration. As a result of that, if you look at that election, we had an election that turned on about 300 votes. Would that 6,000, if they had been caught through voter ID as not being a valid registration, would the election have turned a different direction? I think that question can be asked quite legitimately. That's my primary thing that I wanted to talk about. I also have another, it's hard to prove fraud in all these cases, so in some cases there's nobody to go back to. In these 6,000 votes that were cast, there was not necessarily a way to go back and find who that individual was. So therefore, there's no fraud that can be proved. Therefore, there will be no convictions. So I've heard overwhelming today that it's from people that there is no issue out here. I think there is an issue. Lastly, I have a personal experience where I have a friend whose son was away on basic training, came back in time to vote, came to his place of election, and found that somebody had signed his name on the line before he got there. And that is a situation that I'm sure has not been necessarily investigated, nor do we know how many people who are away at military service are having people voting for them because they're gone. So these are the examples that I have of why I think a voter ID law would be a good thing for the state of Minnesota. I think the details can be worked out to make sure people get their IDs and can vote, and I think that's what this legislature will have to do after the amendment is passed. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kalish.
Yeah, I think your testimony is that 6,000 people voted and they didn't have a right to vote because they didn't have an address, or
no, that's not what I said.
You know, if they were sleeping at that warehouse because they were homeless, that doesn't, I mean, part of what you're making an inference without any facts to back it up that these people were voting twice, people who were not eligible to vote were voting, and you know, there has been, and like you said, there's no proof that anybody did anything wrong on this point, because your only reason for the proof is how many weeks after they voted, they registered to vote, the registration came back to the state.
There were 6,000 of them. Some of them are legitimate. People just went ahead and moved over the time, and therefore there was no.
Sure.
I didn't say that all 6,000 of them were bad, but I'm saying in 6,000 there may have been enough to change an election. That's what I said.
Or may have.
To the chair, Senator Kaler.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Or may have increased the margin of victory.
Absolutely.
And so we always have that. And so your solution for this, you're saying, is that voter ID would have stopped this from happening. At the same time, there's testimony today that, you know, you have, even if you do have 6,000 people that weren't allowed, that should not have voted, I'll give you that. There's 215,000 people that are going to be affected by, that are already registered to vote, that are going to be affected by this law, that have to jump through hoops in order to exercise their rights to vote. And what you're saying that 6,000 people are more important than those 215,000.
Mr. Lebo.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Lebo.
Is somebody saying something to me? I'm not hearing. I'm sorry.
Acknowledge.
I'm sorry.
A little hard.
No,
to get
what
here
I said was the 6,000 is important. Obviously, the other figure that you use is also important. But we don't know yet how we're going to define how these people are going to get an ID. Okay, that's left to the legislature to decide yet. So to say that we're going to disenfranchise anybody at this point, I think is disingenuous, because we don't know yet what the requirements are going to be. Is that not a true statement?
Senator Kalish?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, unfortunately, there isn't any testimony here, and there is no evidence that we can do this for free. And any time an ID costs money and we have people in poverty that can't afford, that would rather pay for food than a new ID, we're going to disenfranchise voters. We're going to have more voter suppression of the people of poverty, people with other disabilities like the testimony was going on today. So the likelihood of having more than 6,000 people of that 215,000 people lose their rights to vote because of poverty, because of all kinds of other life situations, is greater than having a vote, an election overturned because of what you're suggesting is that 6,000 people voted twice or voted illegally. And so your solution is way worse than the problem you're trying to solve.
Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain.
Senator Kalish, I appreciate your comments and your passion, but please have a little sympathy towards our testifier. He is simply here trying to present his view. I would ask that you respect that and respect the testifier. We have respected everybody here today, and I would hope that could continue through the last two or three. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to make one last comment, if I could. He talked about the costs that are involved. We spend a lot of money in this legislature for a lot of things that affect a lot less people. Okay, for instance, light rail transit, who we spend billions of dollars on, and there's small communities that actually take advantage of that. We're talking about the whole voting community of the state of Minnesota. To spend the relatively small amount of money to get a voter ID out there, I think, is nothing compared to what we spend on a lot of other services for smaller groups of constituents.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And just to correct the record, you heard Senator Kalish keep referencing the charge, as you've heard all afternoon. Please read the last sentence of the proposed question that will be on the ballot. The state to provide at no charge an approved photographic identification to eligible voters. Please don't give people the impression that there's going to be a cost for these individuals moving forward. Thanks.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just Senator Peterson, with all due respect, they will have to get to the place to get the free ID, though. There will be costs that might be underlying some of that, and then it is a cost to all of us as a state. So hopefully it won't there won't be a charge to them, but there will be costs in getting to that place of getting an ID. But to the testifier, I'm sorry, I maybe didn't hear it in your testimony. Can you give me an example of where voter fraud occurred?
And I believe these 6,000 votes, that some of them will have been voter fraud, but you can't prove it because there's no person left on the back end to go after.
So there's no instance that
each of these votes that came back, each of these 6,000 votes that came back were actually counted in our election before, and therefore were part of the election results, even though we don't know if there was fraud on them.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we don't know that there was fraud in any of those.
True.
Thank
you. Mr. Liebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
But there is someone that might want to, I might see Secretary of State. Oh.
Senator Sieben?
Mr. Chair, that's what I was just going to ask, if Beth Frazier from the Secretary of State's office could respond to the allegation of the 6,000 voter registration cards being fraudulent.
Yes, Ms. Frazier, did you want to come up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'm Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And I'm afraid that the numbers in the report referenced, again, are somewhat misleading. Last legislative session, there were allegations that there were 22,000 returned postcards. And then when I went through and finally figured out how they were analyzing their data, looking at exactly the same data we'd sent them, they finally reduced their number to now at 6,000. But I've spent the past week or so since the report came out looking at the 6,000. And it looks like, from what I can tell, that more than 700 of the voters cited did not even vote in the November 2008 election. All of these 6,000 voters did Election Day registration, but not all of them did it in November of 2008. Nearly 1,300 of the voters did Election Day registration at other elections, ranging in years from 1996 to 2010. Some of these postcards were sent out because of a changed polling place or another reason years after they'd done Election Day registration and were returned. These numbers include individuals for whom the postcards appear to have been returned due to postal carrier error. A first card was sent out and was returned, but a second card was sent and was not returned and presumed delivered. That's the case for 1,800 of these voters. These numbers still include voters who moved shortly after the election. When you move, if you file a forwarding order with the post office and it comes back, then it's noted in the system, in-state move, out-of-state move.
Excuse me, Ms. Fraser, how many of the 6,000 were cleared and found not to be fraudulent? Because we're getting a little off track here. That was the original question. Are the 6,000 a problem or aren't they an issue at all?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would argue that the 6,000 are not an issue and that it's using data in a way to mischaracterize what happened.
So then why do we monitor the returned ballots when the addresses aren't correct, the returned ones? Why do we monitor those if they don't mean anything?
Mr. Chair, we mark the voter's record so that if they come in to vote at that address, they can be asked questions about, do you really live here? So even if a postcard is sent to somebody years later and it's returned, we flag their record. So if you go in to vote at that address, they'll say, wait a minute, it doesn't look like you actually live here anymore. So that's why we monitor it.
So if they come in, vote at an address, and then it turns out that they're not living there, and we find out as these 6,000, then it does mean something, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, if the person didn't live there, then that is a problem. However, there is not proof that these 6,000 did not live where they said they lived on Election Day. And many of these, they're implying that these were all Election Day registrations in 2008, and many of them were not.
Ms. Fraser, isn't it true that there's no reason to think that they did live there either on Election Day?
Mr. Chair, I don't know why you would draw that conclusion. I mean, people move, and so it's not surprising that postcards are returned.
So then why would we check on them? Anyway, we're going in a circle here. Any other questions for them? Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify. You said you would further ask them if they live there. Then do you just take their word for it, or do you ask them to show whether or not they live there with an ID? How do you know whether or not they truly live there?
Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wolf, the way that the challenge process works under Minnesota statute is that if there's a question about your eligibility, you as the voter are put under oath, and then you're asked a series of questions. And if you answer those questions under oath in a way that indicates that you're eligible, then you are allowed to vote.
Members, in the interest of fair and balance, I'm going to see if Mr. McGrath wants to join us at the table. We can do this. We'll bring a... seems to spend a lot of time studying this and have... You can probably stay if you'd like, Ms. Fraser, if another chair up there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Did you want me to specifically address this return postal verification card issue, or do you want me to just jump into testimony?
You can introduce yourself and give some testimony, and then probably you'll run into the 6,000 at some point in that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. My name's Dan McGrath. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Majority. I'm sure most of you are probably aware that our organization has been doing research into our election integrity issues in Minnesota for the past going on 4 years now. Our research has now led to a record number of convictions for the crime of voter fraud in the state of Minnesota, and it's more convictions that have been obtained in any other state in the nation in the last 50 years. Disappointingly, it wasn't our crackerjack election workers that caught this fraud, but an outside group that was required to not only detect it, but also kind of twist arms to make prosecutions happen. I don't have much faith in our system as a result of that. Minnesota Majority might not be around forever, and I'm sure there are a few people here that would be happy to see us go away, and we won't be around to police the election system anymore. So we need improvements in the process in, I think, a very major way, not just the element of felons voting and unverifiable election day registrants, but a number of other problems. I'm not going to get into all that right now because we're talking about the constitutional amendment. But what I've been hearing today is that somehow providing a free or state-provided identification card at no charge to the voter is going to disenfranchise massive numbers of people. And I have a hard time with this because it's a free identification card that you have 2 years' notice that you need to get before the next general election is going to be coming up. It's astonishing to me. It's almost like the testifiers think there's armies of ninjas that they have to hand-to-hand combat their way through to the DPS station in order to get their free identification card. Some of the arguments I found just ridiculous. The disenfranchisement argument has been brought up largely by the League of Women Voters and some of the allied organizations. They've brought their issue to court. Now, we brought our issue to court. We said, you know what, we think there's voter fraud. Everybody said, prove it, so we did. And people went to jail. But this disenfranchisement argument, when it's been brought to court, it's the opposite has been proven. The courts have said, you haven't provided one person that can attest to the fact that they would be disenfranchised by a voter ID requirement. That was out of the federal court in the Georgia case when the League of Women Voters, NAACP, and Common Cause joined forces to enjoin the voter ID law in Georgia. The League of Women Voters mentioned the Indiana Supreme Court ruling that found no individual voter has alleged that the voter ID law has prevented him or her from voting or inhibited his or her ability to vote in any way. So when this argument has been brought to court, it falls apart. They prove, in fact, no one would be disenfranchised or prevented from voting by a voter ID requirement.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify that?
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where are you talking about? Is this in Georgia?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not in Minnesota. So maybe Georgia needs a constitutional amendment. I mean, it wasn't here, though, right? It was in Georgia. And do we know the court? Do we know who sat on the court in Georgia when they were doing that? I'm just asking. That's okay. We don't have to
answer. Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, I don't know the name of the judge off the top of my head, but I could find the court opinion and email it to you if you like later.
It's pretty desperate, Senator McGuire.
I'm just saying that, yeah, it was. I was wondering if it was Minnesota law or Georgia law that he was referencing. So it wasn't here.
If I can continue, Mr. Chair. I've been hearing a lot of pretty incredible statements here today. Ms. Frazier, I was a little disappointed to hear you say that the voter ID constitutional amendment would somehow eliminate Election Day registration. Nothing could be further from the truth. I think that if you read the bill, it's pretty clear that by requiring equal standards of eligibility verification, there's an intent there to maintain Election Day registration, but to equalize the system. Right now, we have two disparate classes of voters. People who register more than 20 days in advance of an election are subject to a series of verification checks that do not occur for people who register and vote on Election Day. If you're an Election Day registrant, you get to go to the front of the line. You're a specially privileged voter. We trust you. We're not going to check until after we've counted your vote. And when we check after we've counted the vote of several Election Day registrants, we find out they weren't eligible to vote. Or we find out they don't live where they represented themselves to live. Or the address that they provided on their Election Day registration doesn't even exist. Absentee ballots will not be affected by the constitutional amendment that's been proposed here. The only change that I see is you'd either have to provide a photocopy of your ID when you vote by absentee ballot or write your identification card number that can be verified when you cast your absentee ballot. So absentee voting is going to continue to exist. Soldiers overseas are still going to be able to get their ballots and vote. Election Day registration is still going to be a convenience that we can all enjoy. There's a lot of hyperbole on those issues. It's just plain wrong. I think if you read the amendment, you'll be able to see that for yourself. Now, we get back to the postal verification card issue. We released this report just recently clarifying there were actually over 38,000 undeliverable postal verification cards following the 2008 election. Some of them were from previous elections. We boiled it down to only those who were Election Day registrants, and we based that because there appeared to be some data missing from the file that was provided by the Secretary of State's office upon the date of registration. If the registration date matched election day, we presumed that it was an election day registration, even if there wasn't an indicator that they had voted in that particular election. So the 6,000 figure that we're talking about is really people that are highly suspicious, where there isn't another reasonable explanation for why the postcard came back. Of the 38,000, most of them were because people had moved immediately after voting, and that's indicated in the statewide voter registration system. If they provided an in-state or out-of-state forwarding address, the card comes back with that notation on it, and it's noted in SVRS. So the 6,000 are just what's left after we've thrown out all the ones that might have a legitimate excuse, just to clarify on that. And this is important because this is, although not conclusive proof, it is evidence of false identity voting or other types of voter fraud. The reason that the postcard was established in state statute in the first place was to detect and deter voter fraud. That's its purpose. We also have evidence, we're constantly hearing there's no evidence of voter fraud, evidence and sworn testimony of eyewitnesses that include election judges and poll challengers in Minneapolis polling place of students organizing to systematically commit voter fraud by vouching for people they did not personally know that were coming into the precinct. This is under investigation right now by Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County attorney, and the Minneapolis Police Department. This happened in the 2010 election, Ward 3, Precinct 1, I believe, was a Lutheran church on the university campus. So there is evidence of voter fraud. There is evidence of people using voter impersonation. There is evidence of people abusing our vouching system, and evidence, therefore, of the need for photo ID. Now, contrary to the parade of professional activists that we've seen come through here today, the vast majority of Minnesotans, keep in mind, support and demand voter ID. It's an 80% issue. The people who are ordinary Minnesota citizens that want voter ID can't generally make it down to the Capitol at 1 o'clock for a hearing because they're at work. Now, I'm fortunate to be paid to be here today, but most people that hold the position in favor of voter ID have to get out and work to feed their families. While claiming that there is no evidence of voter fraud, the NAACP recently had one of their own leaders convicted on 10 counts of voter impersonation fraud, that never happens, according to the NAACP, their allies, the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, and the like. Now, I'm surprised this didn't come up today, but the Brennan Center for Justice recently issued a report claiming that millions would be disenfranchised by voter ID laws across the country. This is unsubstantiated speculation that has been proven time and time again in court. In addition, we know that disenfranchisement isn't happening in a practical sense because every state that's instituted a voter ID requirement has seen voter participation increase after implementing voter ID. I believe that that's because if you have faith in a system, you're more likely to participate in it. Now, under the felons, I've heard it suggested that the only reason we've got a couple hundred people convicted of voter fraud in Minnesota is because they didn't know that they weren't eligible to vote. They accidentally committed voter fraud. That's impossible. The standard for prosecution and conviction for voter fraud is ineligible voter knowingly votes. It's been proven in a court of law, or it's been confessed to by the perpetrator, that they knew they weren't supposed to vote and did it anyways. So this isn't just an accident, oops, mistake, didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that. They admitted they knew they weren't supposed to vote, and they did so anyways. So we know that people are willing to commit voter fraud in this state. We know that we have the loosest election system in the country. Combining election day registration with vouching is ridiculous. There are only two states in the country that do this.
Mr. McGrath, I hate to interrupt, but we have to change the tape.
Okay.
We wouldn't want to lose your words to posterity.